This chapter increase that we are going through now, the final chapter of the Gita,
is a summary of all the teachings of Krishna in the last 17 chapters. Thus, the verses from 40 to 49 that we have gone through up to 48, but from 40 to 49, Krishna has summarized the path of Karma Yoga. When we take up all our actions, our duties, our responsibilities with an attitude of surrender to the Lord, that is called Karma Yoga, and receive all the results as Ishvara Prasadam. And this is what he has been summarizing from verses 40 to 49. Then from verses 50 to 55, he will summarize the next part that comes after Karma Yoga, and that is Jnana Yoga. So verses 50 to 55 summarize the path of Jnana Yoga. Then in verse 56, he gives a conclusion, a sort of summary, that if we follow his teachings, the path of action, by taking refuge in him, that means if we have total faith in the Lord, and with this faith we do all our duties and responsibilities, with this faith we do all the study of the scriptures, then his promise is you will attain the eternal, indestructible abode, which is moksha. So now let us look at verse number 49, where he is going to conclude the discussion on Karma Yoga. So here, Karma Yoga, if you look at the words that he uses, is not just simply doing good actions, but there is some element of intelligence also involved. We must know what actions we are doing, we must know with what type of motive also we are doing. So here he says, where the person's buddhi, in Karma Yoga we have to use our intelligence also, buddhi. And this buddhi must act in the with an attitude of asakta, unattached. Unattached to what? Sarvatra. So the buddhi, the intellect, which is unattached to sarvatra, which means to every external factor that happens in our life. Therefore, as we go through performing our duties and responsibilities, definitely the external factor can be favorable, can be unfavorable also. Thus, to lead an intelligent life, one has to use the buddhi, the intellect, to understand and not get agitated or disturbed when there is a change in our material possession. Sometime we may have something, sometime we may lose something. When there is a change in relationships or any external situation, we must have that level where we can analyze and put things into perspective. Otherwise, the whole attitude of Karma Yoga will just collapse. Because it is easy to surrender to the Lord when everything is going very smoothly, very nicely. It is when we meet adverse circumstances, then we start to question, what I am doing, how come I don't see the results? So this is where the buddhi, the intellect, has got to come in and start to look at life in a very analytical way and understand that everything that is happening has a cause and an effect. Whatever I'm going through is an effect. There has to be a cause. Nothing that is happening now does not have a cause. Something or other somewhere, you may know about it, you may not know about it, but definitely there is the law of karma, is a law of cause and effect. So if we go back to chapter 2 verse 49, chapter 2 verse 49, there also Krishna, when he talked about Karma Yoga, he used this word, chapter 2 verse 49, page 47. If you see, action performed with equanimity of mind. O Arjuna, seek refuge in Buddhi Yoga. He told him to perform action with equanimity of mind. Equanimity of mind means receiving positive, favorable and unfavorable situations in life with an analytical mind, understanding what is happening. So not just simply reacting, simply getting carried away or simply succumbing to agitation, distress, anger, sorrow. So we have to understand that in Karma Yoga also it's very important to keep our balance there. And that balance can only happen when our intellect is operating and analyzing everything. So we can understand by Buddhi Yoga that the world is neither a source of joy, neither is it a source of sorrow. It depends how I train my mind to handle the situation. The situation is not going to go away. The situation is not going to change. But what can change is how I handle that situation. How do I look upon it? And that is what he's calling here as living a life buddhi asaktaha, unattached to sarvatra, to any situation in life. That is the first quality of a karma yogi. What is the second quality there? So the next quality is in the second line, you see the word jitatma. So jitatma has got two words. One is jita. Jita means one who has gained victory. Victory over what? Atma. So there is jitatma, the one who has gained victory over his atma. And by now you will understand that atma does not mean the consciousness, because the spiritual path is not to gain victory over your consciousness. Here the word atma means again the internal equipment or the mind. So one who is a master of the mind. As Guru Nanak so beautifully put it, man jite jag jite. The one who has conquered his mind has conquered the world. So here means one who is devoid of raga dvesha, does not live his or her life according to whims and fancies. Just feel like doing something, I do. What pleases me, I do. What doesn't please me, I don't do. No. One who has discipline over the mind. One who has overcome the emotions of raga dvesha. So that is called jitatma, a disciplined person who has full mastery over the mind. Third quality is vigata spraha. Vigata spraha means devoid of desires. Again, we have to be very careful. What do you mean by devoid of desires? This is where again our intellect comes in. Because when we analyze everything and put things into perspective, we realize that every material thing, every sensual thing we are chasing after can only give us that temporary happiness. So vigata spraha means being devoid of desires to chase after temporary fleeting objects or objects in the world. Thus, when we say devoid of desires, it does not mean all desires, because in chapter 7, Krishna did say that I am that desire which is not contrary to dharma. Thus, to have any desire which is in accordance to dharma is fine. Here what we are talking about is those desires which go against dharma, adharmic desires. And these also include our time spent unnecessary chasing after wasteful materialistic materialistic and sensual desires. So vigata spraha means being devoid of this what we call unnecessary desires, adharmic desires. Okay? And if you remember that verse also in chapter 9, that beautiful verse in chapter 9 verse 33, anityam asukam lokam. Remember that? The loka, Krishna said, has got two qualities. It is asukam. It has it is full of sorrow. Not that the world cannot give you happiness, but the very source of happiness invariably will turn out to be your source of sorrow. Why is it that anything that gives you happiness has the potential to give you sorrow? Why is that?
Because it's mental.
It's what?
Mental.
Mental.
Attachment.
See, anything upon arrival that gives you joy, upon departure will give you sorrow. That is the law of life. Anything that you obtain that gives you happiness, upon losing it will give you sorrow. And what is the very nature of the world? Anityam. It is anityam. It is not permanent. Nothing in the world is permanent. So the very cause of your happiness will lead to your cause of your joy. For that reason, we must not get attached to things in the world. So here, it means here, vigata spraha, being devoid of adharmic or unnecessary materialistic and sensual desires. And therefore, these are the two main hurdles in our spiritual path. One is desire, one is attachment. What is the difference between desire and attachment? These are the two. Commonly in the Gita they say, you know, reduce your desires, don't have attachment, reduce your desires. Here also he said, don't have attachment and be devoid of desires. So what is the difference between desire and attachment? Desire is you don't have. Attachment is for what you have. So either your mind is occupied with what you have, how to hold on to it, that is attachment. Desire is either you're occupied with what you don't have. How do I get it? Acquisition and preservation. That is what our continuously occupies our mind. Therefore, what happens now when one leaves this path of karma yoga which he has described in the verses from 40 to 49. So here he says, one who has conquered the mind, one who is not dependent on external factors for his peace, and one who has gained victory over material and sense pleasures, what happens to such a person? Adigacchati, such a person will attain. Adigacchati will attain what? State of Paramam, supreme siddhim, perfection. By leading a life of karma yoga, leading a disciplined life, not getting affected by the external factors, being a master of your mind, one will, and surrendering all your actions to the Lord, one will attain the state of supreme perfection, Paramam siddhim. And this state of Paramam siddhim, he has described using one word here in the third line, naishkarmya. Naishkarmya. This word naishkarmya meaning freedom from action. You will attain freedom from action. Why will you attain this state of supreme perfection? Because you have attained the state of freedom from action. What do you mean by freedom from action? Freedom from action is when every type of action that you do neither accumulates a punyam or a papam. So obviously we don't want actions to accumulate papam, we can understand that. But why don't we want actions to accumulate punyam? You have to come back again. Every punyam you accumulate, you have to come back and exhaust it. Thus, when you perform your same duties and responsibilities, the same actions, with an attitude of surrender, that action does not accumulate any punyam, neither is there any papa. So, that state of naishkarmyam, freedom from action, means there is all the karmas, the residue of your karma, is burnt away. You don't create new karmas. And if we go back to chapter 4, verse 37, there also very beautifully he explained. Chapter 4, verse 37, look at the English text, 96, page 96. Chapter 4, verse 37, page 96. So there Krishna said, just like a blazing fire reduces fuel to ashes, even so the fire of knowledge, meaning having the right buddhi to understand and analyze and perform the right actions, reduces all actions to ashes. Meaning what? There is no creation of new karmas. Therefore, whatever action you do, equipped with the right knowledge, will lead to all the karmas being dissolved. There is neither punyam, there is neither pap. That is what is called here as naishkarmya. Or in common terms, it is called nishkama karma. Kama is desire. Nishkama means without desire, we perform our actions. Naishkarmya, the state of freedom from action. There is no accumulation of new karma. And this, you see, this is what Krishna defines here. When we reach this state, where we are performing our duties and responsibilities without accumulating fresh karmas, this is what Krishna defines here as samyasena, that is true renunciation. So renunciation is not giving up the action. Renunciation now has been very clearly defined as performing every action with the right attitude. That is sannyasa. That is the state of renunciation. Because why we say karma yoga, doing the right action, what is karma yoga? Right action plus right attitude. Why do we say karma yoga is the true state of renunciation? How do you conclude that karma yoga is a true state of renunciation? How can you conclude?
It's called the element of purification.
Correct. So what do you mean by that? You mean that karma yoga is a state of the mind. It is not dependent, or rather, sorry, sannyasa is a state of the mind. It is not dependent on whether you stay in an ashrama or you stay in a house or you stay in the forest. It is not dependent on what type of clothes you wear. It is dependent totally on the state of your mind, which can be attained whether you are in the battlefield, whether you are in the household, whether you are at work or whether you are in the ashrama. As long as you can have this attitude, this state of mind, that every action I am doing is a surrender, is an offering to the Lord, then you have attained the state of sannyasa, true renunciation. And then the mind becomes purified and prepares you for the next stage, which he is going to now discuss from verses 50 to 55, which is a summary of jnana yoga. So now, in verse 49 he says, when you reach the state of naishkarmya siddhim, that state of perfection. Now, he is going to tell us, when you reach that state of perfection, what is the next stage there? Okay? What is the next sadhana? And that sadhana is jnana yoga, which consists of shravanam, mananam, nididhyasana. Okay? So that is from verses 50 to 55. So now Krishna says, second line, nibodhame. Nibodhame means now you try to understand what I am trying to tell you, because that means he is going to talk about a different topic already. So he wants Arjuna to pay close attention. Having concluded karma yoga, he says, now understand from me, nibodhame. Why? Because samasena eva, I am going to briefly speak to you about the next sadhana. Why briefly? Because Why briefly? Samasena eva? Because already given in 17 chapters. So this is only a summary. I'm just going to summarize what I have already been speaking about in the last 17 chapters. So what is that which is the next stage? Okay, briefly he's going to elaborate. And he says, yatha, by that process, when you go through this part of purification, okay, when you've gone through karma yoga and purified your internal mind, you are in control of your mind. So he uses the same words here. If you look at the word, siddhim, you see the word in the first line, siddhim, which he used in verse 49, naishkarmya siddhim. So he says, when one has gone through this process and attained the state of siddhim, meaning purification of mind, and as a result, the devotee is discharging all his duties as a surrender to the Lord, then what happens, he says, with that path of karma yoga, one will ultimately apnoti brahma. You will attain that absolute state with the supreme consciousness. So karma yoga will lead you ultimately to merge with that state of supreme consciousness. How? Through jnana yoga. So he is going to explain that also. So he uses the word nishtha. Nishtha means by the culmination of your spiritual studies, you go through karma yoga, you purify your mind, you come to the stage of jnana yoga. When you culminate that jnana yoga path, what is jnana yoga? Systematic study of the scriptures under the guidance of a guru for a period of time. That is definition of jnana yoga. So jnana yoga is not taking out your book once a month and looking at it. That is not jnana yoga. It is a systematic study of the scriptures. So he says nishtha, the consummation or the culmination of this jnanasya, of the path of self-knowledge, you will reach that higher state. So he is introducing now where this karma yoga will lead us to jnana yoga and how jnana yoga will lead us to that ultimate state of merging with the supreme consciousness. There's a very famous line which is very often repeated. It is from the Mundaka Upanishad. It says, Brahma vid brahmeva bhavati. Brahma vid, vid means knowledge. Knowledge of Brahman, once you identify with that supreme consciousness, you no longer identify with your lower consciousness, that is the body, you identify yourself as the higher consciousness. So Brahma vid means knowledge of Brahman, the one who knows Brahman, bhavati becomes Brahman. The one who has knowledge of Brahman accepts that aham brahma asmi, I am Brahman, verily becomes Brahman. Meaning what? You become the very nature of Brahman. Every transaction, every action that you do in life, you no longer operate from the level of your body, you operate from the level of your higher consciousness. So the same actions you're doing, but you're looking at your whole life from a different level, from a higher level, from the level of the supreme consciousness, that I am the witness and I am the consciousness who is in this body. So that's what is meant by Brahmavid Brahmeva Bhavati. The knower of Brahman becomes Brahman. Not that your physical body changes or you have wings in your back or something like that. You are the same person. Mindset changes and how you look at the same life, how you look at the same transactions in a different way. So now Krishna wants to describe that stage of that jnana yoga in verse 51. He says, such a devotee, having gone through all this study of the scriptures, yuktaha becomes endowed. Endowed with what? Yuktaha buddhaya, with an intellect. with a strong or firm intellect, because it has gone through the process of enquiry. And this process of enquiry covers the six fundamental facts of Vedanta that we must all try to understand as much as possible. What are the six fundamental facts? One is Jiva Swarupa. What is the nature of the Jiva, the individual? We have to understand very clearly this. So one is Jiva Swarupa, the Jiva in this body. Second is Ishvara Swarupa. What is the nature of that all-pervading consciousness? So Jiva is the personal consciousness, Ishvara is the all-pervading consciousness. Third is, we must also understand Jagat Swarupam. What is the nature of the world? Because I have to interact with the world. World meaning world of people, objects, situations. I must understand what is the nature of this world. That's why the sages and saints spent years and years analyzing the world. And then they told us, this is the nature of, this is the real nature. Not what you think the world is. The real nature of the world is what? Anityam asukam lokam. Understand this. That is the real nature of the world. If you don't understand and you engage with the world and then you get disappointed, whose fault is it? Now somebody says, I love you today. The same person says, I don't love you tomorrow. And then you get disappointed, whose fault is it? That is the nature of the world. That is how things are going to be. That is how things go on changing. So, Jagat Swarupa, third topic. Fourth is Bandham Swarupa. How does this world bind us? How do we get, why is it we get attached to this world? So we must also understand the nature of binding. And we have gone through this because of the three gunas, sattvic, rajasic and tamasic gunas. Because of these gunas, we get attached to the world also in different ways. Bandham Swarupa. Then once we know that how we are bound to this world, naturally what is the fifth topic? What is the fifth topic? Moksha Swarupa. How do I detach myself from this world? If this world is causing me bondage, how do I detach? What is the process of liberation? And then what will be the sixth logical topic? What is moksha is already described to you. What is bondage has been described to you. What is moksha has been described to you. So the final sixth topic will be, what is the sadhana that will lead me to moksha? So I know what is moksha. I know what is bondage. If I want moksha, I must know the sadhana that leads me to liberation. The methods, how you progress from bondage to liberation. So such a person who has gone through the study of the scriptures, yuktaha buddhaya, the buddhi, the intellect, becomes firmly endowed with this knowledge. Yuktaha becomes firmly endowed with the right knowledge. What type of knowledge? The knowledge which is visudaya. So sudam, you know the word sudam, that which we light in the temple, the camphor, right? That is pure. So the word sudha, visudaya means the mind becomes pure like the camphor you burn. Through this process, through the study of knowledge, the mind becomes pure. Why does it become pure? Because prior to the study of the scriptures, you have so much of ignorance. You have so many doubts in you. You have so many questions in you. You need a lot of answers. Once you've gone through the process of study of the scriptures, everything is put in its proper perspective, life becomes very clear to you. So ignorance goes away, doubts goes away, confusion goes away, definitely your mind becomes a symbol of purity. Pure, visudaya. And he says, equipped with that clarity of mind, clarity of life, what is the next quality of the devotee? Niyamya, controlling, drittaya, with fortitude, with great effort. Atmanam. Atmanam here again refers to the aggregate body, mind, senses. So this person endowed with the knowledge is with fortitude, dhritaya, leads a very disciplined life. See, sometimes when we progress on the spiritual path also, we must be very careful, because there are still a lot of attractions out in the world there. And it is very easy again to fall back again to your old way of thinking, your old way of living. So it does not mean that just because you are endowed with knowledge that, you know, life is going to be very easy. There are still many challenges, there are still many obstacles in the life. So that's why the control of Atmanam, the body discipline, the mind discipline, senses discipline, intellect discipline must be very firm. That's why he uses the word dhritaya, with fortitude, with what you call commitment. You have to live a disciplined life. And why that also is important? Why leading a disciplined life is important? What is the purpose of leading a disciplined life?
Conserve energy.
Exactly. We need to conserve energy that is otherwise wasted in unnecessary pursuits. If we don't discipline and lead a disciplined life, we are wasting our time on so many unnecessary pursuits. Then where is the time to progress on the spiritual path? So discipline of the body, mind, senses, even at the stage of jnana yoga, is very important to ensure that we conserve our energy and direct that energy in the right direction, and that also ensures that there is no spiritual downfall. Because we have seen even great saints and sages also go backwards. Why? Because suddenly one weakness they have in them, and then they lose control of everything. And how do we maintain discipline? He explains here, how does such a person maintain discipline? Tyaktva. Tyaktva means by rejecting shabdadin. Shabdadin is the root word shabda, which means sound. By rejecting sound, visayan, objects. Now, when the scriptures just mention one object for one sense, okay, what they mean is basically all the senses. Because there's no point in just disciplining only the ear and not disciplining your eyes and skin and nose and tongue and all that. So generally when they mention shabda din here means sound, turning away from sound, meaning our ears like to reach out to the world. As I told you, I think last week, that all the five senses are called indriyas in Sanskrit. And another word for indriyas means tentacles. So our senses all are like tentacles. They like to reach outwards. Senses never turn inwards. Equipment do you use to turn inwards? Your intellect can turn inwards. Your mind can turn inwards. But your senses are always turning outwards. Why? Because ears want to interact with some nice sound. Eyes want to interact with some nice form or nice sight. Tongue wants to taste some nice food, and nose wants to smell some nice perfume. So if the senses are not, we don't withdraw our senses, and if you remember the example that Krishna gave in chapter 2, the turtle, exactly. How the turtle withdraws its limbs under the protection of its shell. So what does it mean here? Not just simply, I don't want to see this, I don't want, no, hear no evil, see no evil, like that. We can't do that. So how do you withdraw under the protection of the shell? Shell means what here? The intelligence. So having an intelligent approach to the world. So when we withdraw, the scriptures are constantly warning us that if you do not control your senses, you allow your senses to wander wherever they want, what happens if you don't control your senses? What is the ultimate problem? whatever you let in through your senses registers where?
In the mind.
So it creates a thought. It creates a thought wave already. Right? Samskaras. Right? So everything that is in your mind is coming from the external. And whatever is already in your mind has also come there before from where? Also from your senses. So, and then there was the other famous verse in chapter 2, you remember, that 8 steps downfall of a person. You remember that verse? Verse number 62 and 63, page 53. This one beautifully explained how verses 62 and 63 in chapter 2, the man dwelling on sense objects. Dwelling means you constantly are looking at that, constantly are hearing that, constantly your eyes are looking and looking and looking at that object. The desire is not there yet. But you keep on looking at it and looking at it and looking at it, then what happens? From there creates the attachment. Right? So you say, should I have it? Should I have it? Should I have it? Then you say what? I must have it. I must have it. I must have it. Then what? Then you have had it. Should I have it? Should I have it? I must have it. I must have it. Then you have had it. Because why? Then that thought drives your actions. So that's why they always tell us throughout the scriptures, be aware of your senses. Do not just intake whatever you think, doesn't matter, I hear this, I hear that, I see this, doesn't matter. No, you have to discipline your senses. So rejecting, when we come back to this word, rejecting basically means being aware. Leading again a very disciplined life where you expose your senses so that you don't end up polluting your mind. And especially this is the biggest problem when you come and sit for meditation. Because the thoughts are already in you. You know. And the minute you try to make the mind quiet, all these thoughts are come bursting out. So the less unnecessary, you see, if you keep on exposing your senses, your ear, your eyes, to only spiritual things, what will be the content of your mind? Spiritual. When you sit for meditation, how easy is it going to be? Because whatever thoughts arise will only be spiritual thoughts. But the more garbage and dirt you put in your mind, when you sit for meditation, this is when all the garbage and meditation comes up. And then people say, I cannot meditate. Why? Because normal 20 hours of your time, you are wasting your time putting garbage in that mind. And then in that 15 minutes, how are you going to meditate? So that's why in chapter 6, when Krishna introduced meditation, he did not simply jump into meditation. First he talked about leading a disciplined life. Your waking life, your sleeping life, whether you don't eat too much food, don't eat too little food, don't sleep too much, don't sleep too little, all that is basically disciplining our lives. Then meditation becomes a very easy process. So here he says, reject these sense objects. So be very careful. Be careful what you let in through your senses. And the other quality here in chapter 18. Vyudasya. Raga Dvesha. Vyudasya means eliminating from your life Raga attachment, Dvesha hatred. Raga Dvesha. So you have to transcend. These are the very important things that we have to transcend attachment and hatred also. Because again, the more things you attach to, the more your mind runs after that. The more things you hate, the more your mind runs away from that. Now, Raga Dvesha is basically, the problem with Raga Dvesha is, we are empowering, we are handing over the state of our mind, you are handing over to the world. You are no longer in control. The more Raga Dvesha you have, you hand over that peace of mind, that happiness of mind to the world. For example, if you hate that person, when that person steps in the room, what happens? There is agitation. So what have you done? You have allowed that person to disturb your mind. The more duration you create, the more opportunities there are there for your mind to be disturbed. And the more raga you create, the more opportunities there are. Also, why? Because everything that you are attached to is not going to be there forever. So that's why they say minimize raga duration. Likes and dislikes should be minimized. So, attachment and hatred, view this, you have to eliminate. Verse 52. So how does a jnana yogi, the one who has come now, an advanced spiritual seeker, how does he live his life also? Right? So, what are the... here he is describing the life of a spiritual seeker. He is giving us some pointers also. So the very first point he gives us in verse 52 is Vivikta Sevi. Vivikta Sevi, which means resorting to solitude. It's a very, very important sadhana to take some time away from the crowds and to sit in time for reflection and meditation. So this is a very important sadhana. That's why he's putting that down there, Vivikta Sevi, resorting to solitude. It also includes going to holy places like temples, going for satsangs, going to places of pilgrimage. All these are basically holy places. The more we associate with them, the more pure our mind becomes. And also, it involves us to withdraw, not always withdraw. We are not saying always withdraw from society, but time to time, keep some time aside daily, whether it is 5 minutes or 10 minutes or half an hour, withdraw and use that time to reflect and to meditate. So that moment of quietude. I was just listening to one video by Sadhguru. So same thing he said. He says, when you are studying for an exam, don't you also withdraw? When you need to study for an exam, you what do you do? You don't go and go out for a party and go to a shopping mall and all that. What do? You lock yourself up in a room and you concentrate on your books. In the same way, in the spiritual path, we need that time aside for ourselves also, to keep that time aside. So what they call nowadays, me time. What they call, right? Me time. So you take that time, do reflection, do meditation. Whatever time you have to set for yourself. Whether you want it in the morning, afternoon, evening, night, you have to decide for yourself. So that is Vivikta Sevi, resorting to solitude. And as you do it, initially you may find it to be difficult. Because by nature we need company. We always want somebody to talk to. We find very difficult to be alone by ourselves. But as you do it, you will enjoy that period of solitude. Slowly you will tend to like it more and more. And then you find that you look forward to that period of solitude. So that's number one. Number two, Laghuvasi. Asi, one translation of asi means to eat. Laghu is food that is, well measured in quantity. Okay? So laghuvasi means eat sparingly. Okay? Control your diet, control your food. Again, when the scriptures talk about controlling food, controlling intake, basically it means everything in your life, lead a disciplined life in whatever you do. So eat sparingly, eat food that is beneficial, that is pure and in moderate quantities. And we already saw in chapter 17, what is sattvic food, what is rajasic food, what is tamasic food. So as much as possible, take to sattvic food also. And the Chandogya Upanishad tells us very clearly that food has three portions. One is the gross portion, which affects our gross body. In that food also there is always a subtle portion that affects our subtle body, which is the mind and the intellect. So definitely food has an impact on our emotions, our thoughts, our desires also. So lagvasi. Next quality which we should practice is yatha, one who controls three things. Yatha, vak. Vak means speech. Austerity of speech we have already discussed in chapter 17 verse 15. Right? So all this again is, what he is doing is repeating and summarizing. So yatha means one who controls vak, speech, kaya, body, austerity of body also we discussed chapter 17 verse 14, and manasa, the mind, austerity of mind, chapter 17 verse 16. So one who controls vak, kaya, manasa, speech, body and mind also. And in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras also you will find when he talks about what you call meditation, there is an 8-step process. The 8th final process is when we actually sit down for meditation. He calls it Dhyana Yoga, which chapter 6 also is the same word Krishna uses, Dhyana Yoga. But what are the 7 steps before that? The 7 steps before that are all this discipline of food, discipline of sleep, exercise to keep your body healthy. So all that is listed first, step 1, step 2, step 3, then only you come to meditation. So the first 2 steps are called Yama, Niyama, that means do's and don'ts of life. There are 5 Yamas, there are 5 Niyamas. Then it comes to Asana, the right posture to sit and keep your body healthy. So spiritual progress is not just necessarily going to temple and praying and reading the books and all. It involves a total discipline of our life. That's what we have to understand. So, yatha, vak, kaya, manasa, one who controls the speech, the body and the mind. And there's a very beautiful Sanskrit verse I came across that explains this, how a person leads a very disciplined life. Why should you lead a disciplined life? So this verse in Sanskrit, I'll translate in English for you. It says, the wife is wicked. Don't get angry, just now listen. The wife is wicked. Friends are cheats. Servants are most disobedient. And the house is infested with serpents. Now, if you have such a situation where the wife is wicked, and of course this was written by a man, so wife, woman can change it to the husband is wicked, okay? If friends are cheap, if servants in the house are the most disobedient servants you have, and the house is infested with serpents, if you live in such a house, what kind of situation will be your state of mind? So this verse actually is very allegorical. It's not directly saying that the wife is a wicked person or the husband is a wicked person. What does the spouse refer to here? All very allegorical. What does the spouse refer to here?
Desires.
See, the house is our body, right? Okay, this is what he's telling you. The house is your body. So when they say the spouse is wicked, you are wed to the spouse, right? You cannot run away from the spouse, right? You are wed to the spouse. The same way, in this body, you are wed to the mind. So the spouse refers to the mind. So if your mind is wicked, wicked meaning that it all kinds of wrong thoughts come out in your mind, right? That's why it's a wicked mind, okay? So if your mind is wicked, friends, they say, what are friends? Friends are cheats. So what do you mean by cheats? So cheats are, here is translated as the emotions. All the wrong type of emotions coming from your mind. So they mislead you, they take you in the wrong direction. Just like if you have the wrong type of friends, they will mislead you and take you to the wrong direction, wrong path, to the wrong type of desires. And servants are what? He says servants are most disobedient. So which is the most disobedient part of your body? The sense organs. The senses are the most disobedient part. Very difficult to discipline and control the senses. And then finally he says what? There is snakes in the house. So what is this serpent? What? In your body. What is the serpent?
Ego.
Serpent is the ego. So now imagine you have this body, mind is weaker, all kinds of thoughts coming on which are driving you in the wrong direction. What you call samoha, what is that? The ego is there, always ego is waiting to attack you, you know, like a serpent in the house is waiting to attack you. Sense organs are disobedient, servants are disobedient, sense organs. What would you do in a situation? That's why this verse is saying such a person has got to be vigilant. So knowing that you have such a kind of environment, such a kind of body, what you can do the best is you have to be very vigilant. You have to be in control of this body, this mind, this senses, and also be very careful of your ego, because from time to time this ego will rise up and try to strike you also. So coming back to this verse now, what else should this person do the sadhana? Nityam paraha. Nityam means ever, constantly. Paraha means engaged in what? Dhyana yoga, meditation. So ultimately we all have to come to dhyana yoga meditation. And that also not what we call part-time meditation. That's why he uses the word nityam, meaning daily constant meditation. We have to bring this slowly into our lives. And don't try to sit down the first day 1 hour in meditation, it's not going to work. So slowly, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and slowly increase it according to your capacity. So one who is engaged in constant meditation. And the next quality, samupashrita. Samupashrita means has taken a firm resolve of what? To lead a life of vairagyam, dispassion. So vairagyam samupashrita. Because on the spiritual path, we have to make some sacrifices. That's why there is the path of prayers, there is the path of shreyas. Path of prayers is path of pleasant, path of enjoyment, path of sense enjoyment, material pleasures. Path of shreyas is path of discipline, dedication, what we call commitment and sacrifice. So if you want to progress, you have to make some kind of resolve for vairagyam. Vairagyam here basically means dispassion, meaning again unnecessary wasting time and energy towards the wrong pursuits. So vairagyam also is another important discipline. So these are the practices of a spiritual seeker that Krishna is giving him. Now we come to verse 53. Okay, verse 53. And what are the other qualities he speaks about that we have to acquire? What are the other qualities? So here he talks about the Jivan Mukta. That means now what he is telling you, from Karma Yoga, purify the mind, you have come to Jnana Yoga. Now from Jnana Yoga, this is what you have to attain. This is what you have to achieve. So in verse 52, he gave you the practices. Now in verse 53, he says, Vimuchya. Vimuchya is in the third line, having discarded the what we call the many impurities. So what are the impurities that cause a barrier to our spiritual growth? In chapter 16 verse 4, you remember he gave us all the demoniac qualities. You go back to chapter 16 verse 4, page 281. So there he listed out the demoniacal properties that are in us. Hypocrisy, arrogance, pride, anger, harshness, ignorance, all these are demoniacal qualities which are a barrier to our spiritual growth. So now again, he is revisiting that again, those demonical qualities which are born out of rajas and out of tamas also. So vimukshya means to discard all these six qualities which are our real enemies. What are the enemies? Ahamkara, egoism, self-esteem. You know, I am born in a rich family, I am born in a noble family. Even one who reaches a state of renunciation also can have that ego. I am a great renunciate, I am a great tapasvi. You know. So we must be careful about this ego at all stages of our spiritual growth. Because sometimes even when knowledge comes, we also get this ego that we think we know everything. But that also is a very dangerous thing we have to guard against. So ahamkara, to renounce, to get rid of this ego. Balam, power. Here power means using power and force driven by selfish desires to perpetuate a life of adharma. If force and power is used for to establish dharma, is okay. So what he is saying is to get rid of balam, using power or force to establish or to uphold adharma. That is the dangerous thing. Again, if we go back to chapter 7, verse 11, Krishna said, I am balam, I am that power which is devoid of desire and passion. When you use power for selfless reasons to help others, that kind of power is good. But when we use power driven by our own selfish needs, then that power will bring us down eventually. So balam here means eradicate that use of power or force to establish adharma. Darpam, you can understand, is pride. And one who is intoxicated with all our great achievements, such a person only looks down upon others. And this pride means we don't have any humility, we don't have any gratitude for the Lord. Because we think everything we have done, we have achieved, is because of our own efforts. So the more pride you have, the more you look down upon others, the more you have no gratitude for whatever the Lord has given you. Kama, desires, sensual and materialistic cravings, okay, that also one has to get rid of. Krodham, which is also associated with kama, because when you cannot satisfy desires, then there is anger, there is hatred, there is frustration also. And the final quality he gives, the sixth quality, is parigraham. And this is very important. Parigraham means minimize your possessions. Do not accumulate too many possessions. The more possessions you accumulate, your mind is preoccupied with all this. The more things you have in your life, the more preoccupation you have. Unnecessary things, we just buy and keep in the house. Then becomes a possession. We become preoccupied with that. So, that's why they say, what? Simple living, high thinking. Simplify your life. You don't need so many possessions in our life. So advocate a life of parigraham, minimizing possessions. And that's why our mind again is available to focus on higher goals and noble goals. Instead of thinking about my watches, my collection of watches, my collection of handbags, my collection of shoes and all that, rather we spend our time thinking about more noble goals and higher goals. And what is the result of such a mindset if we are able to cultivate all this? Here he says, nirmamaha, free from mindness also. No, this is mine, that is mine, this belongs to me. Nirmamaha, santaha, the mind becomes calm. When we are free from all this mindness, the mind becomes calm. And such a mind, Krishna says, brahma guyaya kalpate. Kalpate means is fit. Such a mind, devoid of ego, devoid of anger, devoid of desires, kalpate is fit for what? Guyaya, for becoming brahma, for merging with that absolute state of consciousness. Such a person does not identify with his body, with his mind, with his intellect. Because you say this is mine. When you say this is mine means you are identifying with your body. But when you don't consider yourself as this body, then what is there to claim that this is mine, this family is mine, this money is mine? So that thing is to disidentify yourself. But all these are there. It's not that you are physically throwing it away. They are there for us to use. Use it for our purpose to grow. Not use it and get attached to it. That is the difference. Like how we, one Swamiji put it very nicely, like you go to a coffee machine to get a cup, right? Then you use the cup to put coffee in it, right? Then you drink the coffee. Then what do you do with the cup? You take the cup and say, this is my cup now. You know, because I drank coffee from it, so it's my cup. What we do? We discard it. So same way, this body, these possessions are all there for us to use to grow spiritually, not to get attached to them. So, Brahma Bhuyaya Kalpate becomes fit to become Brahman. Now in verse 54, Krishna gives the nature of the person who is fit to become Brahman while living. So this state has to be attained while living. So what are the qualities? Again, this is a checklist for us. He is going to culminate his discussion in verse 66. So he is just coming to the tail end of the Gita, summarizing all the points, and his final teachings will be in chapter 18, verse 66. Okay? We started in which chapter, which verse? When did the first teaching start? Chapter 2, verse 11, exactly. Chapter 2, verse 11, and culminate in chapter 18, verse 66. So, here he says, Brahma Bhuta, one who becomes Brahman, one who has attained the very nature. Now, what do you mean by nature of Brahman while living? What is nature of Brahman? Nature of Brahman is Sat Chit Ananda. So, when one identifies with Sat, is this body Sat? Why is this body not Sat? It doesn't exist in all periods of time. Only Sat is that which exists in all periods of time. Is this body Chit? Chit is consciousness. It is not consciousness, it is inert matter. It is because Atman is there that this body is conscious. So only Brahman is Sat because exists in all periods of time. Only Brahman is Chit because it is a nature of consciousness. Sat Chit and therefore Ananda, total bliss. So when you identify with that, Sat Chit Ananda, means you become the very nature of Brahman. So Brahma Bhuta, one who becomes and identifies with the nature of Brahman, what is the nature? Prasannatma. Prasannatma means Atma which is Prasan, which means tranquility of mind. The immediate benefit is mind becomes tranquil. And very beautiful example, if you remember in chapter 2, Krishna gave of this one who is one with Brahman in this last verses in chapter 2. If you look at verses 69 and 70, he compared the state of one who has become one with Brahman, we can call a Jivan Mukta, or in chapter 2 he used the word Stita Prajna. Stita means steady, prajna means wisdom. One who is endowed with this steady wisdom, you see what he compared it with? That which is night to all beings, the God realized soul is awake. And that which is morning to the, which is night to everybody, when people are sleeping, he is awake. When people are awake, he is sleeping. So who is your God realized soul? See, very allegorical, he's saying, what is night to all beings, the state of God realized soul is he keeps awake. So when everybody is sleeping, he is awake. When everybody is awake, he is sleeping. So who is your God realized soul? Your night watchman, no, you're Jagav. Because at night you all are sleeping, he's awake. So he's the most highly realized soul. So what it means very allegorical? Where people see danger, where people see attraction, the God realized soul keeps awake. Right, there's a saying, fools rush in where angels fear to thrash. So people blindly rush into that, but the God realized soul is very alert that these are the places I should go, these are the places I should not go. And where people run, the God realized soul stays away. Where people stay away from, like satsangs and temples and pilgrimage, the God realized soul is always there. So different perspective of looking at the world, right? One mind is in darkness, that person's mind is in knowledge. And again, verse 70, he says, describing a God realized soul, as the waters enter the ocean, although full on all sides, the ocean remains undisturbed. Again, this is the ocean has got basically two qualities. One is the sun evaporates the waters of the ocean. So the ocean is constantly losing water throughout the day, right? The sun is shining, water is evaporating. But ocean never dries up. Second is, rivers are pouring constantly water into the ocean. The ocean never rises up. So this is the same two qualities of the mind of a jnani. In the same way that the ocean loses water through evaporation, whatever the jnani loses does not disturb him. Whatever comes into his life also does not over-exciting or over-elating. So same allegory used for ocean. Ocean loses water, ocean also gets water, but it remains stable. A jnani can lose anything, it doesn't disturb him. Jnani obtains anything, he doesn't get carried away. His mind remains ever stable. So such is the mind, prasannatma. It is always in state of bliss, a state of contentment, bliss, prasannatma. That is a hallmark of a jnani. Jnani is not one who reacts immediately to the external situation. That is a very confused and disturbed mind. So prasannatma, the nature of a jnani. And what else? The second quality that he gives in verse 54, second line, na sochati, does not grieve. Why is his mind prasannatma? Why is his mind always tranquil? Because na sochati, he does not grieve over what is lost. What is gone is gone. He doesn't grieve over it, does not cry over it. He is able to accept all adverse situations in life calmly. So that is one indication of a jnani. Na sochati. Na kamshati, does not crave for what has not been attained. Because he does not feel he has anything lacking in life. When you feel contented, I have everything I have in life, I don't want anything more. Then what is there for your mind to run after this, run after that? So when you reach that state of inner contentment, you thank the Lord for whatever is given you. The mind does not want to even think, I don't have this, I don't have that. No, because you are ever contented. You never think that you lack anything in life. That's why they always say, look at your blessings, count your blessings. The reason why our mind is troubled, not because of what we have, but because of what we don't have. We are always thinking about what we don't have, and that is what troubles us. But for a person who feels that I have everything in life, I'm very happy and contented in life. And always remember, but that does not mean you don't work. Because if you don't work, then we will refer you to chapter 2, verse 47. Which is what? If you say, I'm contented, that means I no need to work, I'll sleep the whole day, I'm contented. Then we will remind you about chapter 2, verse 47. What is chapter 2, verse 47? This verse you must memorize, because it is the very foundation of Karma Yoga. You have the right to it. No, it is your right. Karma eva adhikaraste. Adhikara means it is your duty, your right to do action. You cannot run away from your duties and responsibilities. So always remember, doesn't mean because I'm contented I give up all my duties and responsibilities. No. Karma neva adhikara. Adhikara means it is your rights, it is your duty to perform duties and actions, your duties and responsibilities. So, na kamshati does not crave for anything, accepts gracefully whatever he has without complaining. Whatever comes, comes, whatever goes, goes. And what is the next quality? Samha sarva bhuteshu. Because, you see, we are talking about a jnani who has attained the state of liberation while living and while interacting with society. So very clear definition, a jnani is not one who runs away and stays in a cave, but one who is interacting constantly with society. What is the nature of this jnani? Sama sarveshu bhuteshu. Samaha means same, sarva all, bhuteshu to all beings. Again, it does not mean that we don't recognize the differences. Some people are hostile to us, some people try to harm us, some people are loving to us. It does not mean that we cannot defend ourselves. We have to take whatever appropriate action. But what is the important thing? What is the important thing? We have the right to protect ourselves. It doesn't mean somebody wants to slap you and then you say chapter 18 verse 54, Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu. No. You have the right to protect yourself. You have the right to defend yourself. But what is the essence?
Staying calm and not
separate the person from the action. Never feel hatred for the person. That person can show hatred to you. You can protect yourself, you can hit the person, you can push the person, but never do it out of anger or hatred, because you create another karmic cycle. So there is nothing wrong to defend yourself, there is nothing wrong to push that person if you are threatened, but never do it with hatred. Understanding that the person and the action are separate. To the person we give love, to the action we give the appropriate reaction or the necessary response. So we must learn that, again, to separate that. So
hatred is creating another karma.
Creating another karma, exactly, yeah. So never do it with hatred. In fact, Ari Shankara explained it so beautifully when he said, you take that, what is that, that what we burn that gives a very nice smell, fragrance. Yeah, what is it made of? That? What is that? Wood?
Sandalwood.
Yes, sandalwood. Sandalwood, by nature, if you burn it, it gives a very fragrance, right? But Shankara says if you take sandalwood and leave it outdoors and it rains, it gets covered with a piece of moss. Then it becomes foul smelling. But that foul smell is not the nature of the sandalwood. And when you scrape away the sandalwood, again you get the fragrance. In the same way, the human being by nature we look upon as purity, as Atman. But it is this covering of ego, anger, jealousy, pride, that is the moss that covers the human being. So to that we give the appropriate action. But to the human being we treat with kindness. Say a prayer for them. Say a prayer for the person, but protect yourself if you need to. So, sama sarveshu bhuteshu. You recognize the differences in actions of different people, but give your love and blessings to all equally. So again, it's not easy because, you know, we have friends, we have foes. It's easy to love our friends, but not easy to love our enemies. But here we are talking about one who has transcended the three gunas, sattvic, rajasic, tamasic, looks upon everyone as the same. And of course, such a person again cannot destroy animals to feed himself. If you look upon all life as pure, then you will not also harm not only human beings but also animals also. Okay. Such a person, Krishna says, labhate will attain mad bhakti, devotion to me, which is the most supreme type of devotion. See, one who goes to temple and prays to Lord, but hates the creation, what kind of difficulty is that? So you can love the Lord only if you love His creation. It's no point to pray and love the Lord but hate His creation. So he says, such a devotee, samam sarveshu bhuteshu, sees the whole creation as one, is what the most supreme devotee of mine, the most supreme, attains the most supreme devotion. And this in the Bhakti Sutras, there are these sutras which are written about the highest stage of Bhakti, is known as Tivra Bhakti, T-I-V-R-A. This is the most highest level of Bhakti you can ever reach, Tivra Bhakti. Intense devotion. What is this Tivra Bhakti? In Narad Bhakti Sutras, he explains this Tivra Bhakti. A bhakti which does not waver according to favorable and unfavorable condition. That is called Tivra Bhakti, the most highest supreme form of bhakti. Whereas everybody has bhakti, but it wavers according to your circumstances. Right? Everything going smoothly, I love you God. Problem in life, God, why you do this to me? But Tivra Bhakti is not. Tivra Bhakti is unwavering devotion. The most supreme, the most purest form of bhakti. And Narad gives this description of Tivra Bhakti in Bhakti Sutras. This is his description. A person engaged in such pure devotional service neither desires anything for sense gratification, there is nothing to ask the Lord for, nor laments for any loss. Whatever he loses, lets it go. Nor hates anything and does not become materialistic enthusiastic. So the bhakti for the Lord is very pure. I have nothing to ask Him. Whatever I lose, I don't blame Him. I do not ask for any materialistic benefits. I just want to love the Lord. That's it. If you remember in chapter 7, Krishna spoke about the four types of devotees. The one who prays to Him to remove obstacles. The one who prays to get something. The one who prays for knowledge. And finally, he says the most highest is the jnani, the one who has nothing to ask the Lord. Okay? So just like if you have four friends, one always coming to you and asking you for money, one who always remembers you when he has problems only, one who only calls you when he has some questions about life to ask you, but the fourth person who comes and asks you, what?
Let's go and see. How are you?
What can I do for you? Not what can you do for me? So out of the four, who will you learn the most? So such is the highest, purest state of bhakti, okay, which Krishna describes as param bhakti or tivra bhakti also. Okay, so I think we almost come to the end of the class, when we resume next week from verse 55. And just to inform you, tomorrow there's one lady coming from Rishikesh, India, to give a talk on chapter 10 of the Gita. She's Mata Vanamali Ji, and she'll be giving a talk in English from I think 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. 1 hour talk. So you all are welcome to come and listen to her. She's a very renowned speaker. She's written a lot of books on Hanuman, Shiva, Ganesha, etc., and also on Bhagavad Gita also. Gita Ashram. Okay. 11:30 to 12:30, followed by lunch. We end with a prayer.
Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kansa Chanura Mardanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishna Vande Jagat Guru.
Thank you. Are you okay? Thank you.
Thank you.